I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on the tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, my guest is Dr. Jeff Serkin, who is a professor here at the University of Texas, El Paso, and happens to be in the studio with me right now, sitting across from me. And Jeff got his MA from Miami University and a PhD in literature from the University of Buffalo. And pretty much right out of graduation, you joined us here in the Department of Creative Writing.
Yes.
And you are a scholar on music. You write about Bob Dylan, you write about Kurt Cobain, you write about punk rock, and you're also somewhat of a expert, I think, if I recall, on Don DeLillo, the fiction of Don DeLillo.
I don't know if I'd say an expert, but I've read a lot of Don DeLillo and written a bit about Don DeLillo.
Well, that's sure. Probably, yeah. You know, yeah. Falls into the category of experts, at least for some of us who've only read maybe one or two of his works. But Dr. Serkin, Jeff Serkin, has come out with a book of poetry, and it is called Traveler's Aid Society. It was just released a few months ago, and we're going to talk about that book. Jeff, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thanks for having me here.
First of all, if we could just start off with just a little bit of your background, just kind of get to know you. Where are you from? How did you come into poetry? You know, whatever about your biography you think would be interesting to
us. Okay. Well, I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. I grew up in Cincinnati, lived there in a suburb outside of Cincinnati, actually, through high school, went to college, came back to Cincinnati, worked there for a few years, went to graduate school, came back to Cincinnati again. And over that time, grew really to love the city and did a lot of research on the history of the city. And also, at the same time, I began playing music in high school. And so through that time in my 20s, when I was an adult living in Cincinnati, I was playing in a lot of punk rock bands, listening to a lot of music, trying to do some writing, mostly playing music and listening to music. And eventually left Cincinnati to go to graduate school in Buffalo in 2002. And it was there that I sort of ended up combining my love of music and my love of literature and poetry and writing a dissertation on representations of popular music in postmodern literature.
Wow. So you actually are a musician that used to play punk rock.
Yeah, used to. I still do.
You still do?
Kind of. Now and again, yeah. Uh-huh. Nothing permanent, but I do play music still.
Well, that's interesting how you keep going back to Cincinnati, and definitely in this book, you keep going back also to Cincinnati. In fact, much of the book takes place all over the world, in Mexico City and Spain and Paris, but you always come back to Cincinnati. And what is it about Cincinnati, other than the fact that you're from there, that keeps drawing you back? Is it the music scene? Is it the history? Is it the...
Yeah, maybe a little of all of the above. I mean, part of it is that it's my hometown, and, you know, I'm not sure that I wanted to be there when I was, like, in high school or, you know, as a young man necessarily, and I wanted to leave, but at the same time, I deeply grew to love Cincinnati. It's got an incredibly interesting history. It's an old city. Compared to a lot of places in the United States, it's an old city. It's got an interesting history in terms of the expansion of the United States into the West. It was a really important industrial city. It was a really important shipping city back in the 19th century and up through the mid-20th century. And plus, I living there for a long time, I've got lots and lots of friends in Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And so I'm still close to a lot of those people, and I like to go back and visit. Also, my parents still live there, so I go back and visit, you know, fairly frequently.
You know, I have a very similar relationship to Fresno, California. I was born there, and probably from the time, until I went off to grad school, there would be years when I wouldn't even leave the Fresno city limits, and I hated it. I wanted to get out so bad.
Yeah.
But the more distant I got from Fresno, the more I was able to see it on a different level. And I suppose, you know, you were talking about being a teenager wanting to get out. I suppose leaving it caused you to look at it in a different way. And I'm wondering the parallels of your research and your scholarship and your intellectual development, how that contributed to seeing, that's kind of a distance too, an intellectual exile, as it were, from Cincinnati, and how that might have influenced your overall poetic vision.
Yeah, I mean, leaving Cincinnati definitely provided a distance that allowed me to look at it in a different way, look at my life there in a different way. Mm-hmm. And also going to graduate school, you know.
In Buffalo?
First at Miami University as a master's student, and then at Buffalo, you know, I really developed a kind of critical scholarly perspective on a lot of things. And one of those things was Cincinnati. I started like looking carefully at the history. I started looking carefully at how it became the city it became. It occurred to me for the first time through having left Cincinnati, the racial segregation that existed in that city and the way my life was impacted by something like racial segregation in the city. Not that I was personally affected, you know, through race, but my life was definitely shaped through the racial segregation of Cincinnati and through the various economic forces, you know, the collapse of the industrial economy in the 1970s and 80s that clearly had an effect in a lot of Midwestern cities.
I'm thinking of your poem, Opening Day, which I think is, to me, it's one of the most powerful poems in the entire collection. Mm. It's rooted in a particular landscape, but it also has a lot of history. And I couldn't help but think as I'm reading this, this is an American poem. This is the kind of poem that Walt Whitman would write. This is the kind of poem that Jack Kerouac would write. I mean, there's just so much about the American city. But there's also a lot of detail, a lot of facts, a lot of information. And I'm wondering, did you do all that research in writing the poem, or did you do all that research and then the poem just kind of grew out of it?
This poem is, you know, a little bit of both, maybe. This poem came out of a trip I took to Cincinnati to do some research. And as part of that research, one of the things I did is I went to the Underground Railroad Freedom Center, which is a relatively new museum in Cincinnati that sort of commemorates and honors the history of the Underground Railroad and African-American migration to the North. And so the poem sort of emerged from my visit to that museum. I just took a lot of notes while I was there of things that I saw in the museum.
Did you know why you were taking notes? Was it just because you were interested, or was there an essay that you were going to write?
That's a good question for me too. You know, did I know why I was taking notes? I have kind of a scattershot approach to research for poetry in that I go somewhere and I just look at things, and things that catch my interest, I sort of follow down the rabbit hole, you know?
Right.
So I knew I wanted to go to the Underground Railroad Freedom Center. I knew that race in Cincinnati, race and racial segregation and racial hierarchies and the history of race laws, et cetera, have had a big effect on the history of Cincinnati. So I was in Cincinnati and I was like, I should check out this museum. I've never been there before. It opened after I left. So I wanted to check it out, see what was there. And while there, you know, I saw a lot of different things, you know, read a lot of different things about the Underground Railroad, about figures in the Underground Railroad. And so I had this collection of notes, and I started writing the poem, started writing a draft of a poem, not really sure where it was going or what it was about. At some point, for instance, I was thinking about how I'd walked out of the front of the museum, and the front of the museum faces this bridge in Cincinnati called the Roebling Bridge.
Yeah. You said it was about as big as the Brooklyn Bridge.
It's not as big as the Brooklyn Bridge, but it's the bridge that Roebling built before the Brooklyn Bridge that became a model.
The same
designer, the same architect. He was the main person building that bridge, and this bridge in Cincinnati was both the first span across the Ohio River, which was a really big deal. Now there's like six bridges or something spanning the Ohio and Cincinnati, but at the time, the only way to get across the Ohio River was by ferry. And so it was a big deal because of that. But then also it was Roebling's model suspension bridge. It was the first cable suspension bridge, I think, built in the U.S. It was a feat of engineering, and it was a brand new technology. Mm. And it became a model for the Brooklyn Bridge, which is much bigger and obviously way more famous.
Right.
But, you know, it occurred to me, I walked outside the front of the museum and saw that bridge there. And I had written that down in my notes, something about wanting to take a walk across the bridge, which you can do now. And I just didn't do it. But I saw it in my notes and I was thinking about it. And suddenly I was like, oh, I'm going to like explore the history of this Roebling suspension bridge, because I didn't really know it. So I did a whole bunch of research on that bridge and on Roebling, and a lot of that ends up in the poem.
Hmm.
And from there, I started thinking about people crossing the river and who was crossing the river and how they were crossing it, and thinking about like when did the bridge open and why. I discovered that the bridge was, you know, started before the Civil War and then stopped construction and then started again in the middle of the Civil War. You know, this corporation was like sort of got its act back together and got the bridge, the process of building the bridge started again in like 1863. It's the middle of the Civil War, you know.
You know, it's interesting. As I'm reading your book, I notice, and this is just a very, very superficial classification because it's much more complex than this, but there's some poems where I find myself completely rooted in landscape. And I think a lot of times the research and the history that you present roots us even deeper into a particular landscape. And perhaps even on a first, second reading, we might even think a deeper meaning. You know, we understand what's going on. We make those connections. We see the loops when you go back to issues like slavery and, you know, the racist, history of your city. But then there's other poems where we're not very rooted at all. And I feel like you're kind of going down a different rabbit hole in those poems, perhaps one not so much based on landscape and facts or history or research, but maybe language. And I'm thinking, for example, you have the kind of poem like on page 73. It's called Between Words and Figures. And it's really a beautiful poem on the level of language, but it doesn't root me as much as some of the other poems. And then you have Sidewalk Clearance. And I'll just read a little bit. Where were you when the dice fell, begging for mercy, a 10% discount on damaged goods, set eyes on the new girl? And the poem, you know, kind of follows this language into not necessarily a concrete landscape. And I'm wondering if your research affects maybe the way you write a poem, or how do you come up with these two different, very vastly different kinds of experiences in your poetry? Some like, I don't know how to describe it, some just language-based, I guess, and then others that are just more concrete.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely two strains of poems in the book. You know, the one is more research-based, and then another one I would describe, at least for myself, as kind of lyric in the sense that it's kind of a speaker's perception and thought, you know, process or something like that. And, you know, this poem, Sidewalk Clearance, it's an older poem, but it's got some of the same interests that end up appearing, I think, in the more research-based poems. There's the new girl behind the counter in Columbus, Indiana. I'm thinking already in this poem about kind of economy and work, you know, and this person in this place, you know, this Columbus, Indiana is a small town south of Indianapolis that I visited once in high school or something. I think I visited it to go see U2 in Indianapolis, now that I think about it.
When you say an earlier poem, what do you mean?
In terms of the book as a whole. So
you wrote this one before all the other
ones? It was probably the first group of poems. Oh. So like maybe possibly 10 years old, something like that. And there's maybe three or four from like a while back in here that fit. As I was putting the book together, I thought that they fit into the larger concerns of the book. And so, you know, there's in this poem, this idea of work and kind of everyday work and everyday people in their work lives. There's the collapse of the antebellum boomtown is an echo of some of the things that you might see in a poem like Opening Day, I think.
Right.
There's ideas of memory. There's ideas of democracy, which for me leads to thinking about issues of freedom. But what happens in a poem like this is it's me kind of following the rabbit hole of not necessarily linear train of thought, makes sense.
Yeah, and you know, I really like the way this poem ends. The last two stanzas, teen lust races us to the bus, sweater season ripe on the horizon, especially that last line, sweater season ripe on the horizon. I love the possibilities of how you can read that, you know, but just, you know, lyrically, it's a beautiful way to end the poem. And
thank you.
I'm wondering if, I guess I kind of want to somehow talk about desire, you know, impulse, you know, what really causes us to create a poem or even to want to write poetry or to create music. You know, there's desire. And I'm wondering how that desire perhaps is different when you're writing a poem that's not based on landscape or research, but is based on following the language, or, you know, how the desires might manifest themselves differently in these kinds of poems. Maybe desire isn't even the word for it. Maybe memory is a better word.
You know, I think it's interesting that you bring up desire in terms of, like, I think you're saying the desire to want to write the poem or something like that. The lines that you read from Sidewalk Clearance, you know, teen lust races us to the bus, sweater season ripe on the horizon. Those lines are about desire,
right.
And they're about like an effective relationship to the world, you know, an effective physical relationship to the world, or both affective and physical. And within all of the poems, I think there's always within, you know, whether it's these more lyric poems or whether it's these more research-based poems, a lot of which incidentally sort of start off as these kind of lyric fragments, that I find something and I just start building on it because I discover a desire to like learn more about something, and then it becomes interesting enough that it gets in the poem. But within like these landscapes, within the, you know, history of the Civil War or the history of the Underground Railroad or the history of this bridge, like always in the back of my mind is the idea of the affective human relationships and the human, you know, the human beings that are framed by, and you might even argue constructed by, the economies and laws and, you know, shapes of the world that they live in. There's real human beings within those spaces. That poem, Opening Day, ends, you know, with a couple of images. One is, you know, the bridge is built and it's opening day for the bridge, and there's hundreds, like over 100,000 people come to see this new bridge, and but they're individual people, you know. And I started thinking as I was writing it, like, who are these people who show up on the opening day of the Roebling Bridge in Cincinnati in 1866, I think it is. And, you know, in the poem, I ask war widow, bartender, legless veteran. I just started thinking, who are these like real human beings living lives in this place and in this time, shaped by this place and time, shaped by the war that just happened and the peace that's allegedly now happening? Through our ability to look back on it, we know that 1866 may have been a hopeful moment, but it was not the end of the story, you know. We could easily argue that the Civil War is not ended at some very fundamental level in this country. And I start thinking, who are these people? What are their real lives? I can't imagine it, you know, but I know that they exist. Just the way, and maybe that's what some of the, what the more lyric poems in this book are about, is like me as a person trying to understand my place in this very complicated world that we can't ever put our finger on. You know, we can never put our finger on the reality of our world.
Right.
Like every time you think you can like pin down something, it slips away from you. You think this is solid reality that I'm living right now. Right. And there's always, you know, if you look closely, you discover, oh, there's some frame, some like law, some cultural idea, some history that's creating my understanding of this moment, you know. Every moment, just kind of every attempt at understanding the moment kind of slips away from you. And I think those lyric poems are trying to understand, you know, what the world is for this speaker,
right,
who
right.
is very not well disguised. You know, it's basically me right. thinking through these issues, you know.
I'm talking to Jeff Serkin. We're talking about his book of poems called Traveler's Aid Society. We're kind of just, I guess, considering this dichotomy, not only between how these poems are received by the reader. You know, we have these lyrical poems and we have these other poems that are rooted in research and rooted in landscape. And I'm wondering if there's a relationship between then desire and memory, and how memory plays a part in the way you write a poem. Is maybe somehow when we write a poem, when you start to write a poem, when you enter into a poem, you're entering into memory and you're unveiling memory and in the process unveiling desire. I'm not quite sure really what I'm trying to ask, other than there just seems to be a lot of allusion to memory here.
Yeah, yeah. There is a lot of memory in the book, in the poems. And I think as I'm writing that, just like it comes up for me. There's some very specific poems in here where I just like go down that rabbit hole of memory.
Right. You know, wherever it takes you.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, kind of, sort of. I mean, that's kind of how it starts, and I end up reshaping the poem, and some bits of memory end up in a poem and some don't. But, you know, like right. the poem, the premises.
I want to bring up an image that you, one of your poems is called The Spirit With Which It Was Offered, and it's about the mixed tape.
Yeah.
In fact, this section is called The Politics of the Mixed Tape, which is the title. The section is called The Politics of the Mixed Tape, which is the first line of this poem. And it really caused me to think about that beautiful metaphorical possibility of the mixed tape. And if you're from our generation or before, you remember the mixed tape. I don't know if kids do that anymore. But mixed tape used to be so important to us as young people, because we're so passionate, we're so full of desire. And when we find somebody that we project that desire on, we make them a mixtape.
Yeah.
And imagine that they're listening to every song and every one of the lyrics with.
Right. And we're spending, we spend so much time like figuring out which songs to put
on.
And
the order of the songs, it matters.
Yeah. What order they go in, how it, you know, goes from more intense to more quiet songs. you know, louder to quieter songs, and you know, the the whole shape of that, it becomes so important, right?
Yeah, and the first line of the poem is, or the first lines is, the politics of the mixtape demand territorial expansion. Kind of go into that line for us. What is that line saying to you? And
what is that line saying to me? Well, you know, it's, again, this is like me beginning with, which I often do, I just begin with an image or a line, right? So sometimes it just like pops into my head. Like I used to take a lot of walks, and as I would be walking, I'd not be thinking about anything particular, and just sort of letting my mind wander, and a phrase would come into my mind, and I'd be like, oh, that's kind of interesting, and I'll write it down in my notebook. And then I'll look back at my notebook later, and I'll see something like the politics of the mixtape, and think, what does that mean? What are the politics of the mixtape, you know? Politics are about the relations between people.
Right,
can think that, right? So that's one way to think about it is, you know, what are the politics of the mixtape in terms of how it constructs relationships between people?
Right.
As I think about it now, I could think of it in a lot of different ways. I couldn't tell you precisely the exact idea I had when I assembled these lines. But, you know, these days when I think about music in general and different ways of thinking about music, I think of the possibility of music as gift as opposed to the as opposed to music as commodity or product.
You know, I remember as I was reading that and thinking about the mixtape, I remember one time I was taking a walk. Luis Alberto Urrea says, you know, quite logically, walking is writing. I mean, I think if you're a writer, you're probably going to do a lot of walking.
Yeah.
I remember I was walking, and on the side of the road, somebody had thrown a CD out the window, and it said, like, from Maria to Jose or something like that, and with love.
Yeah.
And
it's
kind
a
of
tragic story,
immediately
right?
picturing the narrative, you know, Jose saying, the heck with her, and throwing it out the window and stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if, in a sense, poetry, especially this section of your poems in particular, but maybe even all of them, are kind of like a mixtape. I mean, we expect the reader or hope that the reader would look at every single line and go, yeah, I get it, and to feel something and to be as blown away as we are by territorial expansion.
Right.
Because I love that line, by the way. Yeah. I don't know how other readers receive it, but I think, you know, the politics of the mixtape demand territorial expansion makes complete sense to me on so many different metaphorical, intellectual, and even gut levels. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, especially since you are so into music, if this collection has elements of the mixtape.
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting way to look at it. And it fits well with my idea of, you know, this alternate view of music as a gift. You know, if we look at these lines, the politics of the mixtape demand territorial expansion. You know, on the one hand, the mixtape is comprised of all these products that at some level in some boardroom were constructed you know, to be an object that from which somebody could profit.
Right, but not only boardroom, but also from artistic impulse, from desire, because
and
a lot of the music the young listen to is full of desire.
Yeah, and there's all these, both of those things happen in music at the same time. You know, for the artist, oftentimes the music is, and maybe this is our, like, you know, my own sort of utopian vision of art and music and musicians and artists, but that impulse is an impulse of gift-giving. It's like, you know, you both love the music, but you also want to share it with people. You're not doing it just to become a rock star, you know,
or
to become wealthy and famous. At some level, people have that feeling too, I'm sure.
But you really feel it, and it matters.
Yeah, it starts as love, and it starts as desire, and it starts as like a desire to share something with other people, right?
You have this image of a musician who came to Cincinnati to play, came from New Orleans, but had one gig, and then that was it. But just the fact that he would come to one city just to play and then find himself.
Yeah, this was a real, I mean, this is a person I actually met outside the Findlay Market, which is a historic like market, I don't know what you call these things, market pavilion, and over the Rhine, which is just north of downtown Cincinnati, this really old part of town. This is like a real guy I ran into who was selling, he was homeless or lived in a shelter or something, and selling the local homeless newspaper, which I think I call the Homeless Daily in here.
Yeah,
but I
remember those. Yeah. San Francisco, most cities have
them. Yeah, and they're written by homeless people, and the proceeds go to support the homeless shelter or something like that. Anyway, I ran into this guy, and I was just talking to him outside the market in Cincinnati, and he told me, like, you know, I'm a horn player from New Orleans, and I I was like, he was on tour with a band or something and ended up in Cincinnati for a gig, and something happened and he just never left. And
territorial expansion. That's
territorial
what
expansion. I mean, that territorial expansion line, as I think about it, it's like, you know, it's both broadening one's horizons, but then there's some colonial undercurrent there,
right.
Like this idea of grabbing land right. for yourself. And I think, you know,
that's interesting. The mixtape, I didn't see that part, but yeah, I could see
and
it.
The mixtape does both of those things. It's like, you know, you're both expanding your horizons and opening yourself to others, and then also trying to kind of lasso somebody in it.
And you're a poet. This is your book. And one of the things that I'm sure, you know, is happening to you is your understanding that in order to promote the book, you're going to have to expand your territory. You're going to have to go to other cities.
Yeah.
And you're not being pulled there because of the money, because sometimes there's no money involved. Sometimes
there's money involved sometimes?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. You know, and so, yeah, that desire to share your music, you know. But we're kind of running out of time, and I was hoping we'd have enough time for you to read a poem. Unfortunately, we're really, really short of time. I could go on because I have so many other questions about this fantastic book. It's called Traveler's Aid Society, and it's by Jeff Serkin. Maybe you can go ahead and just read that really short poem that we've been referring to about the mixtape.
Oh, okay, sure. The spirit with which it was offered. The politics of the mixtape demand territorial expansion, a freeze in relations or a strategic retreat. A tribute paid in rubles or florins or ducats, echoes of some colonial circus, clowns in the closet, slapstick diplomacy, a greeting postponed due to high-volume truck traffic. A leaf is a leaf, and a hand and its shadow in the dark is no reconciliation.
That's wonderful. That's beautiful. Thank you. And, you know, I guess if we were to think about a mixtape today, because we don't really make them, but aren't there some sort of like programs or Spotify or something where you can make a playlist and send it to your friends?
Yeah, I'm so old fashioned that I still think you can make a mix CD. I don't know.
Yeah, well, you probably could, but hardly anyone can play it anymore.
Right, exactly.
Well, thank you, Dr. Serkin, for joining us. The name of the book is Traveler's Aid Society, and good luck on this. It's a fantastic book. I wanted to ask you so many things about it. But, well, I'll just have to imagine what you would have answered.
Okay. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's been really great. Thank you.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining me for another edition of Words on a Wire. We'll see you next week.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope, but the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place for me. A comedy of errors and I'm falling. Like a rubberneck giraffe, you look into my past. Well, maybe just too blind to see. I'm up in the spotlight. Oh, does it feel right? Well, the altitude seems to get to me. I'm up on a tight wire, flanked by life and the funeral pyre, putting on a show for you to see.